Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 20th of April 1924, the Japanese don't like the Americans, a banker doesn't like fiat money, and nurses don't like their pay. But we'll begin with some of the items that caught my attention this week. Talks have been taking place in London between the British and Soviet governments. There's been a number of articles on the preparations for the British Empire exhibition at Wembley, which is due to open next week. I'm still far from sure what the fuss is all about. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the scrapping of HMS Lion and mused on the value of scrap steel. I surmised that it must have been worth a lot. So I was a bit surprised to learn that one of the Lion's fellow battlecruisers, HMAS Australia, was this week scuttled off the coast of the land it was named after. Apparently Australia didn't have anywhere to scrap it, and the Washington Naval Treaty demanding the ship's prompt decommissioning. So why not take it to somewhere where it could be scrapped? I don't know. A woman's severed leg was found on Wimbledon Common. I think we all know who got the rest of her. There was a short article on how the fez, that symbol of Middle Eastern manhood, that rather impractical symbol of Middle Eastern manhood, is disappearing to be replaced by the siddara. I saw this in Thursday's edition. Mrs. Dorothy Moore, aged 47, of Everton, Liverpool, was laughing at the antics of Felix the Cat on the screen at a local cinema theatre on Tuesday night when she had a seizure and died. All sorts of things are going on in places of entertainment this week. This is from Tuesday. A storm broke out over a question by Mr. Lansbury regarding an incident which had taken place at a communist meeting at the rehearsal theatre. He claimed that two police officers secreted themselves under the platform. Arthur Henderson, the Home Secretary, the Labour Home Secretary, had this to say. The Communist Party as such is not illegal, but the declared policy of certain of its leaders would, if carried out by the methods proposed, involve breaches of the ordinary law of this country. Revolution tends to involve breaking the law. And a certain amount of vigilance on the part of the police is called for if they are to discharge their duty to the rest of the community. I have to confess I'm a bit puzzled by this. I tend to think that the Labour Party of today are communists in all but name, but 100 years ago that proximity would have been greater. Socialism had not failed. The Labour Party believed that the state should own just about everything, including, in theory, corner shops. It's also, as mentioned earlier, cozying up to the world's one communist regime, the Soviet Union. Amusingly, the Soviet Union is not cozying up to the Labour Party. I can only assume that Labour members have a strong attachment to constitutionalist methods. A bill is going through the US Congress, which would end Japanese immigration to the US. This has not gone down well. This is from Monday. The language of the official protest, which was transmitted to the Senate Immigration Committee by Mr. Hughes, the US Secretary of State, has a sharpness not generally found in communications from Tokyo. The immigration bill as it stands is described as a measure which would not only seriously offend the just pride of a friendly nation that has been always earnest and diligent in its efforts to preserve the friendship of your people, but would also seem to involve a question of good faith, and therefore the honour of their government, or at least of its executive branch. Hughes has suggested that Japanese immigration should continue on the existing basis of 3% of the 1910 census. That's 3% a year. Mr. Johnson, the chairman of the House Immigration Committee, and his associates paid no attention whatever to Mr. Hughes's suggestions. They have announced, moreover, that when the time comes from the House and the Senate to reconcile their differences on the question of immigration, the representatives of the House will insist to the bitter end on the enactment of exclusion. Why? Well, the Times doesn't tell us. Maybe there isn't much of an intellectual case being made. This is causing a bit of a headache for President Coolidge. The opinion generally held by those in touch with the President today is that he will neither approve nor veto the immigration bill if it contains the exclusion provision when sent to him, but that he will allow it to become law without his signature. I didn't think that was possible. Though the official attitude towards the Washington decision in regard to the exclusion of Japanese from the United States is one of calm resignation, the public mind is filled with bitter resentment at what is regarded as a humiliation and an insult. The Asahi, a Japanese newspaper, declares that America as a nation of Christianity has disappeared. The Japanese demand for racial equality is one that came up in Geoffrey Drage's letter in the 23rd of March episode. This is just adding fuel to that fire. Having said that, surely if Japanese are just as good as Americans, then Japan would be just as good as America, and there would be no need to emigrate. The US is worried about future ethnic frictions. Some places have them in the here and now. This is from Thursday. A state of wild excitement has existed for some days among the students of the Louvain University, that's in Belgium, as the result of a congress of Flamingon students, I think we'd say Flemish today, Dutch speakers, which was held on Saturday and Sunday, at which some Dutch students were also present. About 2 o'clock this morning, a group of Flamingon students came into collision with a group of Walloon students, French speakers, and disturbances occurred, during which a revolver was fired. One of the Flamingon students was wounded and died later in the morning. I love the way it takes to the end of the second paragraph for the Times to mention that someone was killed. Mind you, it does say positive things about Belgian marksmanship. Talking of which, on Monday the Times reported on the annual general meeting of the Society of Miniature Rifle Clubs. I presume the adjective miniature applies to the calibre rather than the size of the rifles. A letter from Field Marshal Lord Haig was read, in which, after congratulating the Society on the increased interest taken in shooting, compared with previous years, he said, "Personally, I feel that miniature rifle shooting is more important for our countrymen now than at any previous period in our history. Our land forces have been reduced to such an extent that they are hardly able to perform efficiently all that our vast empire needs in time of peace. We must therefore depend more than ever on the voluntary effort of our fellow citizens to defend us all in time of crisis. If the rising generation do not learn how to shoot, the vast possessions of our empire will be at the mercy of any crafty foe in a few years' time." Is that true? Was the collapse of the British Empire the result of poor British riflemen coming up against crafty foes? If not that, then what? It's often claimed that Britain could not afford the Empire, but if the figures I mentioned in the 6th of April episode are to be believed, then the Empire wasn't particularly expensive at all. Did it perhaps get more expensive to maintain? It certainly did after the outbreak of the Second World War, but afterwards, didn't the costs come down? Maybe the British Empire was competing against the welfare state and came off second best. Having said that, it occurs to me that India was the linchpin of the empire. Once Britain had accepted the principle of Indian independence, there was no intellectual reason why it shouldn't accept the principle anywhere else. The point about British rule of India is just how few Britons were involved. Nigel Bigger, in his book Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning, states it was about 1 in 1,000. The empire was something of a conjuring trick. On Thursday, the Times reported on a speech by Sir Felix Schuster, director of the National Provincial Bank Limited. "Discussions were going on in different nations about the return of this country to the resumption of specie payment." In other words, if you, or at least someone, ponies up to the Bank of England with a £5 note in your hand, the bank will give you gold in exchange, or the gold standard for short. "We were still on the aftermath of the war, and any legislation based on those conditions must, in his opinion, be absolutely fatal." I'm not quite sure what he means here. He doesn't elaborate. I suppose what he means is, take your time. One hopes Mr. Churchill is listening. "Not very long ago, we were in close approach to the old relations between the dollar and the pound sterling. In his opinion, there was no reason whatever why the pound sterling should not, before very long, be on pre-war parity with the dollar. And he could not see any reason whatsoever why this could not be brought about without any artificial measures in the natural development and course of events." Well, I can see a reason. There are too many notes. In 1914, the government broke the link with gold. It then started printing money. So if it returned to the gold standard at the same rate as in 1914, and people started taking advantage of the gold window, as it was known, very quickly it would end up without any gold. Why was it that the return of the pound sterling to its pre-war parity was so desirable? Was it only a question of sentiment? Sentiment went a long way, but really it was more than sentiment to have a pound sterling once more re-established all over the world, which could be looked upon as stable and a basis for all international commercial transactions and currencies. It must be based on something tangible, something that was recognized as of intrinsic value in all civilized and also in uncivilized countries. So far, the only material that had been found to serve this purpose was gold. Well, silver too. But that is to quibble. There's another advantage, less boom and bust. It would lower the cost of living and would thus mean an increase of real wages. It would restore confidence and enterprise, and if international relations were to be placed on a footing which would enable the world to resume its normal functions, stability of the exchanges on a sound basis was one of the first essentials. I read the Times from 100 years ago because I find it interesting. Sometimes it is because things have changed. Sometimes it is because things have stayed the same. Sometimes it confirms my prejudices. Sometimes, like with the Labour Party above, it contradicts them. And sometimes it raises questions. Sometimes I can answer them, and sometimes I can't. Here is a particularly rich example. And it's a letter from Wednesday, or published on Wednesday the 16th, from a Mary S. Rundle, Secretary, the College of Nursing, Limited. And immediately we're into a question. The author puts an initial in her name. That's something that Britons almost never do nowadays. Did they do it then? I don't think so. I'll have to watch out for any examples. Also, the College of Nursing. It is now known as the Royal College of Nursing, but it is not an educational institution. It is a trade union, as we will find out. It is a commonplace of life that the wealth of a nation lies in its people rather than in their material possessions, and that the race which continues to produce an adequate supply of healthy citizens will eventually possess the earth. Some reactions. 1. The use of the word commonplace to mean a commonly used phrase, when today it is more often used to mean a physical thing. I think it would be truer to say that the future wealth of a nation lies in its people. But you would also have to add in their incentives. But I would have to admit that's probably beyond the remit of a trade union boss. The use of the word race. I think she means nation rather than skin colour or other characteristic. 4. She would appear to believe that possessing the earth is a good thing, not an idea you hear expressed a good deal these days outside Russia, China, and the Islamic world, and certainly not by a trade unionist. The infant mortality figure, until recently, gave occasion for grave alarm in the country. Did it? My understanding is that the previous 100 years has seen a dramatic decline in infant mortality. The outstanding cause of death amongst infants, 90% of whom are reckoned to be normal and healthy at birth, is parental ignorance. I'll have to take her word for this. But ignorance of what? Occasionally you will hear the phrase, the man in Whitehall knows best. It is usually used to mock the arrogance of civil servants and experts. But what if it is, once in a while, true? That the infant mortality rate has been reduced from 130 per 1,000 births to 70, in what time period, she doesn't say, has been due to the visiting in homes and the instruction in health given to parents by health visitors and school nurses, under the direction of medical officers of health. The aim of the public health worker has been to save life by giving sound instruction in the laws of healthy living. That may well be true for the most part, although one always has to make allowances for medical fads. But I would be curious to know who these medical officers are. I presume they are government officials, but central or local government? It would have been supposed that those to whose devoted work the reduction in the infant death rate has been largely due would have earned the gratitude of the nation, but this is far from being the case. At last, some trade unionism. My members deserve more money. The majority of medical officers of health agree that the work of a health visitor and school nurse should be carried out by the best type of trained nurse. I am not an expert on nursing, but I suspect the best nurses then, as now, have other uses. And how would you know who the best nurses are? Or what the opinions of the majority of medical officers are? It is, however, difficult to attract highly trained nurses to a life where they cannot do more than earn a bare living. The average salary offered is barely £150 per annum, rising to a maximum of £180. £150 is about 30 ounces of gold. At the time of recording, gold is going bananas, which gives us £54,000. Applying the Crozier fudge factor brings that figure down to £27,000, which doesn't sound so bad. Out of this, the worker has to provide board and lodging, costing at least £2.10 weekly. That's about £125 out of the £150 salary. Ouch! It's worth bearing in mind that in those days, board, that is, food, would have taken up the greater share of the board and lodging. And her own cycle in many cases. She has to clothe herself, provide books to keep up with her professional interests, and pay for her holiday. Pay for her holiday? Surely a holiday is a discretionary expenditure. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. This leaves no margin for any adequate insurance against sickness and old age. For this salary, she is expected to produce evidence of training in a general hospital, midwifery training, and a special certificate for health workers, and to use the utmost skill and judgment, much physical endurance, unfailing tact, and kindness in carrying out her duties. Kindness and tact, eh? Well, that certainly dates it. Just in case you thought that nurses complaining about their pay was a new thing. The College of Nursing, which represents the interests of trained nurses, is fighting a battle on behalf of the nurse in public health work to ensure her standard of training, a professional status, and a little more than a bare living. An adequate salary, which would be what precisely, will be some acknowledgement from the public that these women, try saying that today, are at least worthy of a remuneration on which they can live in a reasonable standard of comfort and be able to make some provision for sickness and old age. Worthy, eh? Which is exactly the same argument that is used today. Of course, pay is determined by supply and demand. Yes, the demand for nurses is high, but so, for reasons I don't entirely understand, is the supply. But surely everyone is covered by the state pension by this time. Mind you, I suspect then as now, you wouldn't want it to be your only source of income. Anyway, that is all for this week. Hopefully you will have been elevated to a level of erudition from which the only way is down, unless that is you listen to next week's episode, assuming there is one, or assuming there isn't, some of the previous episodes. In the meantime, I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.